Hello again, you are listening to Stephen Davidson's Looking Back on Our City Radio. Today we're joined by a comedy superstar of the future, Ivo Graham. Welcome to Our City Radio.
Thank you very much for having me.
Two weeks into the Fringe now, Ivo, how is the show going so far?
Very tired. So, very tired. The show I'm enjoying the show very much. I'm proud of it.
What is it called and where is it on? Let people know straight away.
Wow, plugging straight off the bat. Yep. Usually you have to earn it by being funny through the internet.
Let's get it out of the way, Ivo.
Yeah, listen to this and then switch off. My show is at 8:15 at the Pleasance That, which is one of those little porta cabins near the Pleasance Courtyard, very dignified. And it's called Bowties and Johnnies, which is a funny title.
And traditionally, Ivo, comedians always say they're getting good audiences. Are you going to carry that on and say that yours is doing really well audience-wise?
It's doing okay. It's never been empty.
Right. Okay, that's positive. You did your first solo show last year, Ivo, which traditionally includes all the best material from starting stand-up up to that point. Was it tricky to leave the favourite gags behind, the golden bankers that you'd live with for so long?
No, because I resented most of them hugely. Right. I hated telling them as much as they hated being told by me. I think it was a very, very good creative exercise in just getting rid of it and writing a new one in a few months. I think that the danger is of having those bits which are knocked about for years and you don't deliver them with the same enthusiasm anymore. You're completely on autopilot. And also, they often, not to be too sort of indulgent and pretentious about it, but I think they can refer back to a sort of person that you, particularly if you tell autobiographical stand-up, and I do, then your old bits refer back to a person you're sort of not necessarily anymore. So there's a slight sort of disconnect between old and new stuff. So I would say that this new show feels much more coherent because it was written in a very concentrated period of time about a much more concentrated subject. It's fresher, and I'm more excited about doing it every day. And it's not to say that the golden oldies don't occasionally rear their very ugly heads at club sets around the land. But no, it was good to get rid of that hour.
And is this now you on a never-ending loop of building up a fresh hour doing Edinburgh every year? Do you think you'll become one of those comedians?
I think it's a good exercise. I did think at about sort of April stage of this year when I had nothing about what on earth I was doing coming back. But then I realised how purposeless if not life, then certainly comedy life would feel without a show to work towards this year. I think it's a very, very good thing to keep yourself writing an hour a year. It's not, at the end of the day, the most overwhelmingly large amount of, you know, you can fill it up with any old flab and I love doing a festival, so I hope I will come most years.
And is it the theme there? An awful lot of comedians have a theme. Is the theme crucial to a solo show these days?
No, I think it can be slightly over. I think they can overplay that a bit. I think that the theme of my show is just to be funny, but it's not always gone that way, it must be said. So it's good to have something more pretentious to fall back on. Mine's definitely got a sort of fairly flimsy premise which it sets out at the start and then sort of recaps on at the end, but I don't think anyone is walking out of the venue scratching their chins and going, I learned a great deal from that.
Yeah, and bottom line, nothing really matters apart from it being funny, does it?
I think that's it. I think the problem is audiences come to, you know, four or five shows a day. You have to do very well to stick in their memory beyond, oh, that we enjoyed that show.
Yeah.
It's one of the amazing things when people come back and see a gig, you know, sort of, or see you perform again sort of a few weeks or months later. You can often get away with doing the same stuff again because the memory does just blur into one a bit. I don't mean that I'm constantly looking for excuses never to write jokes. I just more mean that actually you can think in your head that the message of your Edinburgh show is some brilliantly important moral, and actually it will be forgotten by people 5 minutes after they've had their first beer after the show.
Yeah.
So it's good not to get too invested in it.
And if they are walking out of your show saying to each other, what a remarkable theme that was, rather than that was funny, it's a problem.
Then it's probably, yes, exactly. They may have got the wrong thing from it. Although, God, I wish a couple of people would say that.
Okay, well, this show is very much about the distant past, but I'd like to give you to give me just a kind of 1 minute snapshot with no time penalties of your stand up life so far. Kind of from the point when you just thought, I'd like to give stand up a go, to the point when you're standing on stage. Just brief.
With no time penalties?
No.
What does that mean?
It means you've got a minute. I'm going to give you a minute to do it, but if you go over the minute, I won't care.
No hesitation, repetition or deviation. I started, it's not a very interesting story, starting stand-up. I tried it at university because at school there had been a little comedy society which I was very sort of keen to be a part of, but wasn't in with the right people. So I squirreled it away and arrived at university where I knew no one and just did a 5-minute spot at a try stand-up comedy night without having told anyone, on the premise, which seemed a very likely premise, that if it was a disaster, no one would know and I'd be able to put that sort of fantasy to bed. Instead, as it turned out, it was actually quite mediocre. So its inherent non-disastrousness meant that you then wanted to go back and do it again and do it better. And I did manage to survive about 5 or 6 gigs on the uni circuit before having my first horrible, horrible, horrible death. And by then, it was too late. The flame was lit. So I just kept doing it all the way through my degree. My marks slipped. My comedy improved. And I've been doing it for 2 years, almost fully professionally since leaving university, which has been very exciting.
Excellent. So that's very much the modern day Ivo Graham. We're gonna play a record now and then look into what my researchers have told me is both a murky and a shimmering past.
Oh, it's so murky.
This is Our City Radio. It's Shotgun Lover by the North. Today on Looking Back is one of Britain's brightest new comedy stars, the fantastic Mr. Ivo Graham, who began telling jokes on stage at the tender age of just 18 years old. With your permission, Ivo, I would like to look into the distant past way before you had any thoughts of a stand-up career. I'd like to arrange the corner bits, the middle bits and the edgy bits of the jigsaw puzzle that came together to form a picture of stand-up comedian Ivo Graham. Ivo, are you willing to step into an elevator with me which will descend into your past?
What an amazing cavalcade of mixed metaphors. I would love to do all of those things. Let's step into that elevator and make that jigsaw.
I'd like to start way back, before your life even begins. Your father, this has been documented in the press a lot, but your father is hip-hop legend Big Chip, Compton's most notorious gangster rapper, and your mother is Italian politician Gelato Graham. How on earth did they get together, Ivo?
I suppose if that's one thing I didn't want to have to talk about today, it was my father's hip-hop career. But it's all anyone ever wants to talk about. Straight out of Compton, he was I suppose his rhymes, the rhymes that he spat and continues to spit, have been a great influence on my comedy. His fearlessness, his homophobia is something that I've tried to keep up in my comedy as well. I think it's very prevalent in the rap scene. It's important that people keep flying that flag today, which is interesting because my mother has been a massive campaigner for gay rights on the Italian political scene. And I respect that too, just not on stage. And they met in, I think it was 1986, when my father was doing his European rap tour,
yep.
Which was called...
Can't have been that much of a memorable tour, Ivo, I don't think.
Well, I think, as I've made clear, he was more interested in offstage shenanigans than onstage. Yeah. I think it was mainly a quest to see if my father, who was in his sexual prime right then, if not his artistic prime, could bed as many European politicians as he could. And he set himself a target of five, and he had sex with, I believe, just one. But what a happy union that proved to be for a few years before the inevitable divorce.
And that magically led to the birth of one Hector Ivanovich Graham Graham at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles. Do you have any idea why your parents made your middle name the same as your surname?
I think it's because Graham is a very important name to both my mother and father, not just because it was already their surname, because my father was a huge fan of the Golden Grahams cereal, which he would famously eat before going on stage at every concert, whereas my mother was a huge fan of the football manager George Graham.
Yep.
And they were keen to basically, if you like a name like that much and it has that many powerful associations for you, you just really want to hammer it in. And my mother's also got a stutter, so her saying my name can be very amusing.
Perfect. And this very colourful beginning of your life that I'm about to speak about, it's been covered many times. Do you have any clear memories of being entered into the One Ring to Rule Them All baby boxing tournament?
I don't really. I suppose the combination of the fact that it was at a very early age in my life, and of course the massive amounts of head injuries I sustained during my many, many defeats, have left me with very, very few memories. I suppose I resent my parents for entering me into it when I was knocked out and so badly beaten in the first round time and time again.
Well, Big Chip has been quoted. He's been quoted as saying that he felt guilty because he put you in for it when you were only 6 months old when he signed you up, and the baby boxers are all supposed to be at least 1 year old. That must have played a part.
Yeah, I suppose. I suppose most rappers do believe that, because rap, as we all know, is just as much about the beefs as it is about the beats.
Yeah.
So I suppose, though it seems awful, I'm sure by the standards of modern morality to enter a six-month-old into a boxing tournament, I suppose my father just wanted me to be trained up and ready to support him in his many, many Los Angeles-based rap beefs as quickly as possible. And I just only feel embarrassed that I was to prove myself so lacking on infant boxing circuit.
Yeah, so that obviously affected your relationship with your dad. I mean, and he was obviously looking at you and thinking, you know, I was looking for a little tough guy, and he's ended up with, no offence, but Ivo Graham.
No, I know, and I think it was very tough for him to watch me sort of drift away, spending a lot more time with my mother, sort of working on Italian sort of political legislation with her from a very young age, going to a lot of Arsenal matches, and really taking increasingly little interest in my father. But then... And he took very little interest in me. I think that, you know, once I'd proved myself a sort of weak fighter, he wasn't proud. In fact, he famously said his head after my last defeat that he was so ashamed he would never eat Golden Grahams again, which he then turned into his a number one rap hit, No More Golden Grahams. I think even the commercial success of the song didn't prove much comfort for him.
Hearing that is tough to hear, and I'm going to go over even more painful ground, I'm afraid. But as a child, do you have any recollections at all of the 60 affairs that your mum confessed to Oprah Winfrey about? Did any of these men, did they try and be your friend? Were you aware of them? It's a queue, basically, isn't it?
Yeah, and I insisted on vetting them all personally from a very young age. And actually, it may surprise you to hear this, particularly after paternal disillusionment that I felt in the early 90s, after the fighting, the many, many serial-based rap hits, I was very keen to see my mother happy, and it was an absolute honour to watch some of the rising stars of Italian politics, media and culture walk through the door of our Venetian villa, and then walk through the door into my mother's bedroom, whereupon I saw nothing more, because obviously a son's vetting can only go so far. But it was a treat. They were very good to me, and I've even after their relationships burnt out with my mother, it's still been an absolute joy to go back and holiday with so many of them over the last 20 years.
That's good. There's a bit of a bright light, a bit of a positivity about that. But shortly after that, the men walk into your mother's bedroom, as you say, and then your mother walks out of your life, leaving you with just Big Chip and you with all that knowledge of what's happened. I mean, did you tell Big Chip? Did you tell your dad?
He'd read a bit about it in the newspapers, the Italian newspapers, but it'd been translated for him by one of the more literate members of his posse, I think is the word. But I think he did take it hard, but I think I recognise, even at a young age, just quite how hypocritical he was being, given the many famous orgies that he was both hosting and participating in on the sort of Hollywood swingers scene. But I think it's harder. I think it's certainly harder for a husband to have an Italian newspaper article entitled "Politician Given the Once Over by Junior Minister for Culture" than it is for a wife to read an article saying "Rap Star Involved in Grotesque Golden Grahams Based Orgy," and this was a relapse, obviously.
Yeah. I mean, I realise this is just getting upsetting for you now, isn't it?
It is
this particular
bit.
Let's move on. So we get to the point where your mum's disappeared, and you and Big Chip are living alone.
Disappeared, I must stress, from my life, but not from Italian political life.
Yeah,
she remained a very important player on the scene for far longer than was expected of her.
You and Big Chip, you're living alone in Anaheim at the age of three, and your dad's fortune is slowly gambled away on pig racing. Did he ever take you to the races?
He did take me to races. He was very keen that I ride a pig, but it was stressed very forcibly by the staff at the Anaheim Pig Racing Day Out that he was not allowed to do so. Regardless, there were of course a lot of "Do you know who I am"s uttered, and the answer was invariably no. Just to watch, to be honest, was a treat. I think it's a lot of people say pig racing is inhumane. In fact, it's one of the many things that my mother campaigned against back in Italy, although I think this again was just to get back at my father. I'm not sure how much he actually believes it. But it was a real joy as a three-year-old to see sort of sport in its purest fashion. And then obviously in the traditional banquet after every race, yeah, where the pigs are slaughtered.
And is it still all the pigs apart from the winner?
All the pigs, apart from the winner, is given a massage and then slaughtered. Yeah. That is his privilege.
I can't.
I know it seems.
I've seen it on TV, but I can't imagine being there and seeing the endy bit that you've just.
No, described. You're absolutely right, and I think that it both saddens me and amuses me that there are so many innocent pig racing watching fans out there who think that the whole thing ends in just a sort of, you know, with sort of fireworks and rosettes and not actually the bloody abattoir that is, yeah, the end of every natural pig racing.
Yeah. And I said, well, you shouldn't really be gambling on pig racing, should you? If you're not willing to accept that, you know, it's a bit like people who eat fish but aren't willing to. I mean, I'm a bit like this myself. I wouldn't fish for them, catch them, kill them. You know, you shouldn't be gambling on pigs if you're not willing to see them slaughtered at the end.
It's true, but that's why at every sort of gambling stand at these pig racing events, it always has all the odds, and underneath they always have the same slogan, which is "One thing you can bet on is you'll be having a delicious bacon sandwich at the end," which is it's nice to have that reassurance, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it's a bit of truth in amongst the magic, I suppose. But there's about maybe 2 minutes of the pig racing. It played a massive part in your life, obviously, at that time. But in the film of your dad's life, which I watched for the first time recently, at the point he moves away from hip-hop and decides to start recording religious music, the actor playing you at the age of four says the phrase, "Dad, you're no longer my dad. These are dead beats."
Direct quote.
Do you feel that strongly quote in real life? That is absolutely true, is it?
Yes, I pushed very, very hard for that line to make it into the final screenplay. Yeah. Many people said it was unrealistic that a four-year-old would say something both so world-weary and so musically insightful, but I insisted. I managed to give them the CCTV evidence from my father's mansion come recording studio, and they finally gave in to my demands. And I'm pleased with the presentation of myself in the film. Not so sure about my father. I think it's hard for him to watch it back. I think his I think once he started moving into religious music, he wanted to pretend that he'd never, you know, he'd never been a rapper. And so obviously to watch this film, which reminds him of his past sins, was tough. But I hope that he took some small solace from just what a pretentious little ass his 4-year-old son was.
And you're obviously bang on the money. Can you step back into the mind of the 4-year-old Ivo? And was your problem with the religious music the worry that your dad would fritter away all his success, lose all his fans? Were you worried about the financial side of it, or creatively did you just think it was poor?
I suppose, of course, there were financial worries. I was sort of temping as my father's accountant at the time, and so was able to sort of to look at the sort of effects of this, you know, the sales of the new album, which were poorer. But I didn't worry about how it would trickle down to me. For a start, I had faith that my father would be all right, still sitting on a very big money pile from the rap days, his pig racing winnings, Golden Grahams. The phone didn't stop ringing for them, saying, just if you'll come back to us, there is so much lucrative sponsorship there for you.
Yeah.
So I thought he'd be all right. And more to the point, I would be more than happy to ditch my father and go away and live with the many Italian men that had offered themselves up to me as a potential stepfather.
Yeah.
So I knew that I was going to be okay, regardless of him. As for the music, I think fair play to him. It was a bold move. Very few of his original fans came with him on that journey. And to be honest, very few of the sort of religious music fans were prepared to welcome into their world a pig slaughtering, orgy hosting former rap megastar. But I think there was enough curiosity around the time of the first album that its sales hit, if not platinum, then certainly tin levels. Obviously, the second album was a disaster. But by that point, I think my father had lost faith in the project.
And to be fair to him, although he took many wrong turns in his life, but he saw you to a solid educational start at the Sisters of the Seven Souls Primary School, where you found yourself in the same class as Pippa Middleton.
I did.
And
yes.
Is this the point where you decide to pretend to be posh?
Yeah, I think that was probably it, obviously.
Or that's certainly maybe the beginning.
I certainly don't think I had much involvement with the English upper classes before then. You know, spending my time, as I say, sort of divided between Los Angeles and Lake Como. You know, I don't think I'd ever even been to England. And I suppose that I found it exciting. I found Pippa a fascinating company. I don't wish to be crude, but even at that age, an absolutely terrific body and a voice, this plummy voice, which to me is someone who's spoken this sort of awful sort of mixture of sort of Los Angeles drawl and sort of fruity Italian warble picked up from my parents, combined with an almost Tourette's-like sort of need to shout sort of pig racing chants at every opportunity. It was nice to be taught received pronunciation, and I think my meeting with her really set things off.
And it's a double whammy, I suppose, as well, because Pippa Middleton comes into your life, and also at that point comes, and I'm going to see the smile beam across your face, I know, but the teacher, Mr. Chevonian.
Yes.
Known to you now as
God rest his soul.
Papa Chev. I mean, what are your first memories of Papa Chev?
I suppose my first memory of Papa Chev was when, well, I think it was probably my first day at the school. I'd not met Pippa yet, but I'd walked into the school and wearing my sort of LA Lakers big sort of hoodie with an Arsenal shirt underneath, because it's even sartorial, I was loyal to both of my parents. And he took me to one side and he said, after class, I'm sure you'll have noticed that that Arsenal and the time difference works out that Arsenal and the Lakers are playing games at exactly the same time. And in my office, I've actually got a sort of split screen television where we can watch both those matches together. Mm. Now, obviously, in the current day, being invited back to watch multiple sports matches at once by an elderly teacher on one's first day at school would sound like the beginning to some sort of horrific story. But his intentions were purely sporting. And it became the first of many, many, many very happy afternoons with Mr. Chevonian, who loved sport and I think was rather fond of me.
Yeah, and I, The song that we're going to play now, it's a song that you've described previously as the soundtrack to the 6th year of your life. Mm. And I think Papa Chef perhaps introduced this song to you. But can you tell us why Don't Turn Your Back by Day Old Hate is so important to you?
I love this song because its title of the song and of the band is so, it's so sort of potent and so relevant. It's fair and not overly self-involved to say that by the age of 6 I'd been through, you know, more than most 6-year-olds, and had more than enough reason to sort of cut sever ties entirely with both of my parents, and probably in fact make a killing from the many secrets I could have spilled on both of their lives to the American and Italian press. But I'm glad, looking back now, that I didn't do that. That I kept faith in them both, and I realised they were just both flawed humans who wanted, if not the best for me, then certainly me, you know, to be okay. And any hatred I did feel for them was, if you don't mind me saying, just never lasted any more than a day, or certainly not at least until the next misdemeanor or orgy. So it's those powers of forgiveness which I think the song really sort of emphasizes, and which meant a lot to me at the time.
And this is Day Old Hate on Our City Radio.
There's nothing left to say or do. I've got no point to make or prove. This life has nothing left. I refuse to find a way out. I'll just lose. And now there's nothing left to say. I'll save my woes for another day. There's just no way, there's just no way. I'll hit my knees and start to pray. So take a look at what you've done. You've got to fight for what you want. I'll pick myself up and make a smile. An empty pocket will last for a while. If it does, I won't run them out. Just watch me. My friends and family will be there to help. They'll keep me happy and keep me well. My life won't be a living hell with them by my side. So take a fight.
The wonderful Ivo Graham is here with us on Looking Back on Our City Radio. So now, Ivo, we come to the unusual phase in your life, which takes up an entire chapter of your autobiography. Between the ages of 7 and 8, you're writing 30 poems a day.
I mean, yes.
The two questions, right? Why and what on earth did you find to write about at that age?
I was addicted to poetry. I think, obviously, as I said, it's in my blood. When your father's a rapper, the apple very rarely falls too far from the tree in that respect, and I loved poetry. I suppose a good 27 to 28 of my 30 a day poem habit was devoted to odes to Pippa, obviously.
Yeah.
Desperately trying to win her heart and move out of the quite awkward friend zone that I'd created for myself quite early on. And then the remaining ones I would mix up, sometimes a sort of surreal poem, sometimes something a bit more sort of political, and often a fairly sort of angry barbed at one of the many bad decisions my parents had made up in my life up to that point.
And I spoke to Papa Shev about that period, and he says that at that point he was unsure if you were a genius or an idiot. Did you even know yourself?
I was very, very sure I was a genius. I don't think the question of idiot even crossed my mind. And what I would say about Papa Shev is if he did have any suspicions that I was an idiot, he certainly didn't show them at the time. He was hugely encouraging. He was a sort of co-writer. He bought me all the stationery required to write them with. He helped me write poems about the sports we enjoyed watching together. He even suggested that some of my Arsenal-based poems were good enough to make it into potential match day chants. So if I did have any self-belief at the time, it was only swelled by the daily encouragement of Papa Shev.
So at this point, you're riding at the very top of a wave of just joy at the poetry that you've written. And
absolutely.
Then from the very top of that wave, we come to another hugely traumatic period in your life when Big Chip fakes his own death to boost record sales. I mean, how much did you know about that whole thing?
But I did plan it with him in a way, I've never talked about this before, but actually I was far more in on the plot than it was actually reported at the time. Obviously, it's more convenient to have the son pictured sort of sobbing outside a hospital than it is to know that actually he was the one who masterminded the entire thing. But I thought that, as I say, the sales of his second Christian rock album were disastrous. The third didn't even chart. So I thought that classic sort of rock star death scandal combined with obviously the very sort of Christian analogy of returning from the dead would really be the thing that sent his fourth album skyrocketing into the lower reaches of the top 400. And at number 376, it did peak. So I suppose if I look back on that decision with anything, it is pride.
Yeah. So at this point, Gelato has gone. She's disappeared. Later to return, but we'll get onto that in a bit. And Big Chip is gone, but you know he's not really gone, but he has had to disappear, leaving you. Basically, Papa Shev comes back in. He invites you to come and live with him, but what he describes as a spare room turns out to be just a large industrial bin at the back of his house. That must have been a difficult time.
Tough when you've lived in LA mansion after LA mansion and villa after villa and then gone to school with Pippa Middleton and heard about some of the places that that she used to frequent to find myself at the age of six, was it?
Yeah.
In an industrial bin. It's a shame. But on the other hand, I knew it was important for my poetry.
Yeah.
I knew that I was starting to suspect that endless boasts about how great my life was and how great my football team was and how beautiful Pippa was meant nothing to the burgeoning fan base I was developing in the schoolyard. So actually a few tales of hardship, days in the bin, one, two and three, which was probably my best received poem, was exactly the sort of the creative challenge I needed.
And what happens next, Ivo, it's an extraordinary twist of fate in that it played a part in shaping the life that you'd kind of begun to create for yourself. During the night, and you're asleep, I don't think you know when it arrives, but during the night someone dumps a scruffy eaten blazer into the bin.
Yes.
And does that spark something in you? Does that stoke the fire started by your brief time as Pippa's friend?
I recognised the blazer immediately, obviously, because I'd spent a lot of time we would read books about eating together after school, because she was very fixated on it, because she had this great sort of predilection that she was going to become a part of that world at some day, and she would I would say perhaps I could too, Pippa, which point she would always laugh and turn her back on me, which obviously, as anyone who knows anything about Pippa's physique would know, is always an absolute treat.
Yeah.
However, the arrival of this blazer or tailcoat, to go by its correct name, was definitely felt like the clutch of destiny. However, vomit and feces stained it may have been as it was thrown into the bin, I nonetheless pulled it on with pride and felt, as I pulled it on, like Joseph with his Technicolor dream coat, the colours in this case being vomit and feces, that it was the start of a very new and important chapter in my life.
Yeah, but and you go into school the next day. Is this true that I've heard this? You go into school the next day wearing the Eton blazer and wearing talking blazer. In a posh voice. I mean, how did your friends react to that?
Well, they smelt me a mile off, fairly horrified by that. But as I say, I'd already started to sort of confuse them with this new poetic persona that I'd been cultivating, that I was some sort of dark street, bin-dwelling street urchin. So if anything, they were fascinated to see what sort of new role I was going to play and what effect it would have on my art. I think they were fascinated. They didn't recognise the uniform, obviously, but they knew that it was something quite special, and I think they treated me with great respect that day.
Yeah, and out of interest, Ivo, can you still do your old voice, the one that you had before?
To be honest, I'm very keen not to return to those days. I suppose the problem is that you and your listeners would not even recognise it as an accent. It would sound to you like a sort of a 23-year-old posh man just trying to make a voice up to sound as ridiculous as possible. You know, if I were to say, "Oh yeah, I'll just come back from the bin wearing this new Eden blazer covered in vomit," you'd say, "Ivor, you have no talent for accents at all. Where is that accent from?" I'll tell you where it's from. It's from Los Angeles via Italy, via a bin, via 6 years of hardship.
Yeah, and I thank you so much for doing that. I mean, I can see why you changed it.
No, exactly. I'm amazed I lasted that long, to be honest, and I can see why so many people fled my poetry recitals so early.
And I suppose you even risking doing it there, is there part of your, a bit like smoking, I suppose, the back of your brain you think, "I'm going to be stuck with this again"?
No, not that I've stuck with it. I don't think I'll ever return to that voice again. And in fact, I think I'll make a point of asking my publicist to insist that no future interviewers ask me to do it. So you're very lucky in a way that that you sort of got me before that cutoff point. However, it is funny to talk like that and to be transported back to the old days. And I suppose if I do pass a bin on my way home today, I might just climb into it just for the nostalgic feel of the whole thing.
Yeah, and I absolutely appreciate you opening yourself up. And if I wouldn't talk about it again or do the voice again. You're right. Let's get on to cheerier times, happier times. You steal your best friend's skateboard, and this is remarkable. Within 4 months, you are the skateboarding world champion. On the day you receive the cup, Big Chip comes back into your life.
You're sweet to sound so sort of surprised by it, as if it was a happy coincidence, rather than Big Chip at this ailing stage in his musical career, just trying to attach himself to any sort of success whatsoever. It was amazing that the theft of a skateboard, which I maintain was entirely legitimate. I was trying to escape some bullies who were bullying me about my voice, and I'm sure your listeners will be able to appreciate why. And in the process of one escape, I managed to pop so many wheelies and endos that I discovered a talent which would see me, which, as I say, sort of crowned a worldwide champion.
World champion.
Yeah, a world champion, and see a success which I'd not known. Which I'd not known in my sort of infant cage fighting days, nor in the pig racing field. However, I suppose when I stepped onto the ramp for the grand skateboarding final, sponsored by Tony Hawk, I did think to myself, I wonder if I win this, will I see a familiar paternal face emerging from the crowd, you know, sort of shouting about an imminent new album release? Mm. And sure enough, there he was, my reincarnated father. And I'd mixed feelings that day, sort of love, sadness, quite a bad graze on my right knee, if you want to break an omelette. But I think love is the main one.
And so this, your dad's back in your life, and your mum comes back as well, because you've got the skateboarding success on the back of that. Your dad's got a bit of money. You move back into a bigger house. Big Chip's there. Gelato's there with your dad again. And you decide to flee the USA and your family and come to Britain. I mean, why?
Well, it seems mad now, doesn't it, to look back at that, and you'd think, God, all a six-year-old would ever dream of, to win a skateboarding championship and reunite his parents with the money that he's won. And I was sort of proud that it had provided a sort of a very minimal boost to my father's musical career, and actually a quite massive PR boost for my mother's political career, because there were rumours in the Italian press that she didn't even approve of skateboarding as a young person's pursuit. So to have a child win a world tournament it was a great boon. But I became tired of being used. My thoughts inevitably after one cloying family dinner too many, my thoughts turned to Pippa, to that Eton tailcoat, and to the potential new life that I'd already started to devise myself on British shores. So I booked myself a flight first class and headed straight for the mean streets of Windsor and Eton.
And then you get to the aircraft, you booked your first class ticket, and they're not going to let you on because you're too young, you're unaccompanied, and they don't quite like the way things are set up. So is this true? You dress up as a steward and somehow blag your way onto the flight. Is that true?
Absolutely, yes. I managed to enlist out, but short notice, of one of my friends, an old skateboarding cronies from my school. We did the old classic on each other's shoulders, yeah, long coat trick, which I must stress is much harder to do on an aeroplane going through turbulence than it is to do on terra firma. But yes, it worked. It worked an absolute treat. It was a shame to see him arrested at customs the other end because the customs had fallen apart. But I, as it's writ in British law that if one is discovered trying to enter the country with another person in a long coat, the person at the top will be granted access, whereas the person at the bottom will be imprisoned for 40 years. And it was a shame that, you know, he had lost. But that is just a twist of fate that I cannot sympathise with.
Collateral damage. Really.
Collateral damage, exactly.
Yeah. Is it? This is maybe just a made-up story for the film as well, but is it true that you did the safety demonstration on the flight and said, if we get into any trouble, just try and get out the windows?
Yes, I did say that. I suppose I did see that safety demonstration as my first ever stand-up comedy performance.
Yeah.
In many ways, and that was, if anything, I'm annoyed that that's the quote that survived, because I said some far funnier. Yeah. I mean, my 5 minutes on the airline food now would seem very cliched, but at the time I think was really quite forward thinking.
And you arrive in the UK. I mean, it's your spiritual home, and you head for Nottingham. You build a shack in the woods of Sherwood Forest.
Yes.
You enrol at Nottingham High School and you proceed to play the part of your own dad at parents' nights. I mean, that must have been tricky to pull off. Did you use the same?
Yeah, so it was exactly the same trick again. I was able to get my friend granted day release for these sort of parents' days, so he could come up and play the bottom half again. Although I think for him it was very much sort of a horrible series of flashbacks, but for me it worked very well, and I enjoyed impersonating my father very much. I did look an enormous amount like him at this point.
Did you create a new father figure, or were you trying to be Big Chip? I wasn't.
Oh no, no, I was trying to be Big Chip. Luckily, his reputation had plummeted to such an extent that he was a complete unknown on British soil. His UK tour sold very well. For just four people came to see him live at Nottingham, and luckily none of them were connected with the school. So I was able to play the part of this sort of idiotic, gurning, fallen rap idol without anyone suspecting that there was any actual connection between me and him.
It's lovely how you've been through so many troubles. You know, probably today's probably been like getting hit by an emotional baseball bat in the
face. Absolutely.
But thank you so much for going into such depth. I mean, I'd like to bring it back. I'd like to give this story a happy ending. I loved how you missed it out. But let's talk about the bus, because basically you see a poster at university and you're thinking about doing stand-up comedy. But the night when you made your debut, I know that you hadn't actually intended to go round. And then you see a double-decker bus pull up in front of your house, and it stays there for a long time. And then you go out and you say to the driver, what are you doing here? And he's there to take you to the gig. Do you know yet who booked it? What? How it came about?
I don't think I'll ever know. And I've given my parents more than enough chances to say, son, it was me. I really want to believe it was Papa Shiv, really.
Yeah.
Who I'd, if I'm honest, fallen out of touch with. I think he probably suspected that I wasn't writing so many poems anymore, that my creative talents were not being fostered, and And I think what better solution than to conduct an enormous amount of research into where I was studying, enlist the help of a double-decker bus, and have me driven to a first-ever comedy gig. Whoever's gesture it was, I'm hugely grateful for it, because it started me down a very happy road.
You've been amazing today. I'd like to finish off, if you don't mind, with the short, sharp standby or catch a ship section, which basically I read you quotes that you've said during your life, and you either stand by them or you distance yourself from them. You know, if you stick with it, you say yes, stand by, and if you want to just, you know, you say catch a ship.
Okay.
You can elaborate if you like, but these are some of your quotes. In every fifth orange, there is a secret message.
I stand by that very much. I see the orange is the fortune cookie of the fruit world.
If I could find the right kind of cape, I would always wear a cape.
That's a misquote, so I suppose.
Catch a ship.
Catch a ship, yes. I have found the right cape.
There should be a law that forces women to do the dishes.
I stand by that. No further explanation.
And finally, Ivo, I am so good that in 5 years all the other comedians will have given up.
Five? No, catch a ship. I think that's very, very flattering. But I've got a more realistic aim, which is for most comedians just to have retired in about 60 years. If anything, not to do with my talent, just because of natural retirement age.
Okay, Ivo, it's been a huge pleasure. And to bring the curtain down, we finish up with the song which you've chosen to be played at your funeral.
Yes.
Can you tell us, why have you chosen Come On by Northern Sugar?
It was the song that was playing before my first ever stand-up comedy gig. And so it's been the song that I've played as my intro music to every gig I've done since. It makes me feel an enormous surge of great self-belief.
Hector Ivanovich Graham, thank you very much for looking back with us, and we wish you the very best of luck going forward.
Thank you.
This is Northern Sugar with Come On Our City Radio.
Can't you see? Can't you see? F-O-I-T-U-N-E. Can't you see?